Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with physician and UNC assistant professor and researcher Dr. Arjun Deb about heart regeneration, science, not fiction. I like this topic.
I do, too. I'm really excited to talk with him.
But I'm scared, Christy, because we're talking about basic science, and that was not necessarily my strong point in medical school, but one that I realize is important for everyone.
Yeah, well, if we can get him to bring it down so that we can understand it, hopefully that'll help us all understand it. But first, we've got some research that matters.
And hopefully we'll bring it down.
Hopefully we will.
Our very first one, not about bringing it down, it's really about taking it off. This is some interesting research about... Do doctors perform skin exams, or maybe why they don't perform skin exams, why they don't have patients take their clothes off to perform skin exams?
Yeah, so this was a study done in the Archives of Dermatology, really showing that doctors may not be performing full body skin exams for a variety of reasons, but that it may be, according to surveys, related to time, other illnesses that doctors need to take care of, and patient embarrassment.
And another factor, does the Preventive Medicine Services Task Force, the group, Christy, that I know you hold out as a Bible at times, telling doctors what they should and shouldn't do, their recommendation on skin cancer screening says there's not enough evidence for or against it. So maybe a lot of family doctors are saying, well, if there's not enough evidence for it, we don't necessarily need to be doing it.
Yeah, I actually did a whole big project on this for continuing medical education for doctors when I was doing my public health degree for secondary skin prevention, or trying to prevent skin cancers early. And it's something that's near and dear to me, because my father died of melanoma. But in this study, it really showed that more dermatologists do these full body skin exams than family doctors and internists, which to me, I read this and think, okay, well, that makes sense. A dermatologist is a skin doctor and should be doing these exams. And when you really look at the evidence, it's more effective on the people who are at higher risk. Someone like me, who's got a strong family history and problems.
But I will say that there have been a number of patients that I've uncovered melanomas and one person who I said, oh, you know, I probably should have you take your shirt off, you know. And I think a lot of times, and patients will say, you know, this doctor never even examined me. They never even lifted my shirt up to listen to my lungs. So I think we need to avoid complacency. We do need to follow the evidence. But I think perhaps that we should be, at least when we're doing physical exams on patients, having them put a gown on rather than having them leave their clothes on.
And I'd also say that if you are a patient who has had a lot of sunburns, who have anybody in your family with skin cancer, it's a good idea to ask your doctor to examine your skin. Okay,
well, asking doctors and doctors and blood pressure control and how many medicines should you be on? This is the subject of our next Research That Matters from an article in The Lancet.
This is a study looking at the difference between starting when you have high blood pressure, whether you start with one medication or whether from the get-go you start on a combination medicine of two medicines at once.
And I was always taught, start low and go slow. So start with one, and if you haven't reached a maximum control after reaching the maximum dose of that medicine over a number of weeks, if not even longer, maybe add another. But this research maybe suggests something different.
Yeah, and this is something I've heard a lot from Dr. Anthony Vieira in our own department, who does high blood pressure research about, you know, if someone's blood pressure is really running close to 160, it may be more effective to go ahead and start two medications because you're going to need them anyway. This is really looking to say, looking at this study, they started some people on just one medication, some people on two at the same time, and then after a period of time, for the people who weren't controlled, added a second medication and really found a pretty significant difference.
Well, the blood pressure was certainly lower, in the group that got the two, and that's not real surprising. They said that the side effects were similar in both group. But I'll be honest, Christy, I'm still very apprehensive. I know that it's certainly if it's higher there, but it's been high for a long time, and the urgency of getting it down necessarily so low to start with is not as great for me. And I still worry about side effects. I see so many, and I know you do too, people who have side effects from blood pressure medicines. And the more medicines you use, the more likely you're going to get side effects. I don't think there's any way around that. So I hear it, but I'm still worried.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that in this study, there wasn't a difference in side effects between the people on two versus one. But I think, you know, we know they work in different ways. And since most people need more than one medication to treat their blood pressure anyway, we know that. You know, it may be that it seems to be that there's growing evidence to support going ahead and starting on two different medicines, and they've got a lot of them that are combined into one pill, even on the generic $4 list at Walmart or Target.
So different ways of hearing this research. And this next one, though, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, I suspect Christy and I are going to be right in conjunction with, which this is the use of antidepressants for hot flashes. What do you think, Christy?
I think I read this and thought, okay, well, this is great to know that it works on this with this particular medicine for depression called escitalopram, that it works to help reduce hot flashes. But we already knew this with fluoxetine and Prozac. I prescribe this pretty regularly to patients who are looking for a reduction in their hot flashes. And so now we know it works with another medicine of the same group. So right. It wasn't new to me.
Not new, but perhaps maybe new to maybe some of our colleagues who don't have time to look at all the literature, maybe new to listeners out there who may not know that antidepressants in general actually work well for hot flashes, particularly since estrogens have become less popular, less commonly used.
Sure.
Patient the other day with hot flashes who I started on one of these antidepressant type medications for the treatment of the hot flash. What kind of response can they expect based on something like this?
Well, I mean, this literature, this particular study did see a reduction in the hot flashes. And I'm also impressed that many of my patients feel, you know, perhaps if they had a little bit of depressive symptoms, feel better in that way. Or maybe they're just feeling better because they're not suffering from so many hot flashes.
Yeah, well, the hot flashes did go down. You're right. They went down significantly from 9.8 hot flashes a day to 5 per day. On the other hand, the placebo group also got better, so it suggests there are other mechanisms fully, but it's real. There are side effects, but I think that both of us probably use these types of medicines for hot flashes now more commonly than we did a decade ago.
And it's nice that they work even at a relatively low dose, so that's encouraging to patients.
Yep. What's our very last one, real quickly?
It's about nursing homes, and nursing homes closing down.
And in effect of the economy.
It affected the economy, but it was a little disheartening to read that it's happening more often in poor neighborhoods, in urban and minority neighborhoods, and perhaps affecting more people of lower income, more vulnerable people than the wealthier.
Right. It's not just a function that these are worser nursing homes, but a function probably that they are on Medicare and Medicaid and not the private ones with the higher reimbursements, which also means then if you've got loved ones that need nursing home care, which is baby boom is getting older, including me, we're going to need it, that you'll have less access and you'll have to go further away. This is disconcerting news. I don't know what we do with this, Christy, right now. Other than make nursing homes, we have to take some ownership for them in our communities.
I completely agree with you on that one. So we've had a chance to talk a little bit about nursing home closing down more often in the minority and poor neighborhoods, a little bit about antidepressants for hot flashes.
A little bit about encouraging your physician, particularly if you're at high risk, to go on and do a full unclothed exam with the gown there.
And a little bit about starting on two blood pressure medicines versus one blood pressure medicine when you have a new diagnosis of high blood pressure.
Well, that's going to conclude Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Arjun Deb about heart regeneration, science, not fiction.
You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Arjun Deb about heart regeneration. That's right, we're talking about heart regeneration, or the heart healing itself, or us helping it heal.
And we titled it Science, Not Fiction, because it's really happening. And we have our wonderful guest today, Dr. Arjun Deb, who is an assistant professor and researcher at UNC School of Medicine. Dr. Deb's research has won many awards, and that's actually how came to our attention, seeing some of these awards he won, looking at the biology of what's called adult stem cells. And we'll talk about those and many other things and how they are targeted to actually help organs repair and regenerate. Welcome to the show, Dr. Deb.
Thank you for having me here.
You know, Dr. Deb, we, Adam and I are family doctors, so we love to hear our patient stories and our colleagues' stories, and we'd love to start out with your story of how you got to this place to be such an expert in this area.
Well, it started when I was in training. I was at the Mayo Clinic as a physician, training to be a cardiology fellow. And very early in my training, I realized that as much as progress we had made in the treatment of patients with heart disease, there were really some gaping holes, and we were really limited in what we could do for our patients long term. And so that really sparked in me an interest for following cardiovascular research. And I would say, in short, I got into a research lab there, and it was a stem cell lab, and I really was excited with the implications of stem cell research. And then I continued my training at Duke University, where I was with the stem cell biology program. And then I was very fortunate to be recruited to UNC, and where I had my own independent laboratory and continued working on how stem cells can be used and how the heart can repair better after heart attack.
Can we back up and talk about what is a stem cell?
Yeah, let's define a stem cell, because I think it is, when I hear stem cells, I hear Congress coming in and something happening between Republicans and Democrats. Tell us, what are stem cells and why are they even controversial?
Yeah, so I think the whole political issue is about embryonic stem cells. And so stem cells, very simply—
Those that come from embryos.
Yes. So stem cells, very simply, can be thought of as those which you can isolate from embryos, called embryonic stem cells. And so obviously there's a big political and ethical debate about that, and I shouldn't go into that for this talk. But the other form of stem cells is adult stem cells, which, you know, every human, every animal has stem cells in various tissues. And these stem cells can be isolated. They have a function. And so those are types of cells which I work with and many others in the heart field work with. And so these stem cells are fascinating because, for one, they can give rise to a daughter stem cell. And two, it can actually give rise to the tissue in question. So, for example, a heart cell, heart stem cell can give rise to heart tissue. A liver stem cell can give rise to liver tissue. Skin stem cell into skin tissue, and so on. So there's a way—
basic cells that can then divide and become like new heart tissue?
Exactly. And at the same time, it can replenish itself, maintaining a pool of those stem cells, so it doesn't get, you know, sort of stem cell population doesn't diminish with time.
Well, I know that when I was coming through medical school, there was this, you understood the fact that if you had the liver and you lost 90% of your liver, that the liver had this ability to somehow regenerate a little bit and you could still really do really well. But my belief was, well, the heart, once the heart muscle was gone, you developed heart failure, and then that was it.
Yeah.
Is that the thinking, or has the thinking changed some?
No, I think you've hit the nail on the target, and that is that thinking hasn't really changed over the last so many years. And that is, some tissues in the body have an amazing ability to really regenerate. Just for example, as you said, if you cut out two-thirds of a person's liver, it'll grow back exactly to the same shape and size as it was before you cut it. Now, we all know we can have scratches in our skin, we can have torn skin, and our skin grows back. You know, cells in our gastrointestinal tract, they are replenished in an amazing manner. But at the same time, if you have a spinal cord injury, or if you have a stroke, or if you have a heart attack, you know, your heart cells die, they don't grow back, your nerve cells die, you're left with deficits. And so there are some...
The question is why.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are... And some people have talked about dividing organs into organs which regenerate and which don't, and understanding why this is so innately.
And so you're trying to identify these very basic cells of the heart in your research that you can manipulate that will then help people grow their heart back?
Yeah, so I think...
Is that the basic gist, or break it down for us?
No, absolutely. So for years, or for the over the last 5 to 6 years, I think an amazing number of discoveries have been made about stem cells residing in the heart. But the fundamental question to which I was getting to in this project was to really understand, well, if there are these stem cells in the heart, what happens to them? Why don't they kick in after a heart attack mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, get back our heart muscle? Why are we left with only scar tissue? And mm-hmm. And so that was one of the questions we were trying to get at. And, you know, what is interesting is that we're not chasing an illusion here. For example, in lower animals, we know that if you cut the heart of a fish, for example, and many other organs for that matter, the organs grow back. And so there exists in nature this innate ability to regrow. But why we don't have it, that's the question.
We're sitting here talking with Dr. Arjun Deb at UNC about his really pioneering work on stem cells and regeneration of the heart. And Dr. Deb, you clearly are doing research in an area that affects people. And everyone in the everyone in our listeners probably has a story of someone who's had heart injury, a heart attack. You must know that this connection between your basic science research and what is their stories is quite real. How do you really manage this tension between knowing that the work you're doing can ultimately affect virtually every person in the state? That's got to be a heavy responsibility.
Yeah, it is a heavy responsibility, but I think like many other physician scientists, it is a pleasure too. To think that whatever research and whatever you're trying to accomplish in the lab, if the experiments work and you do make a difference, it can really affect lives of so many people, not just here, but across the world. And that, I think, keeps me going and keeps many other people going. To work late nights in the lab, to come in early in the morning, I think that's important.
Yeah, you know, I was just looking at the story of the solving of Pompe disease, that big movie that was out with Harrison Ford. But one of the enduring images that I think is probably true is the scientist sitting in the laboratory exceedingly late at night, really working on experiments. What's one of the major experiments that you are working on right now?
So we have several projects, but I think one of the most interesting projects we are right now dealing is understanding how the heart heals. So as I said, when the heart, after somebody has a heart attack, this sort of heart muscle dies. And
scar tissue,
exactly. And this heart muscle is replaced by scar tissue. And we're trying to find out how does the scar tissue really form, and what are the molecular mechanisms giving rise to the scar tissue? And
because that's not a good thing, right? Having scar tissue after a heart attack is not like having a scar after you've cut yourself.
Yeah, it may be a good and bad thing, and that's what we were surprised with. What we found out was that if you inhibit this scar tissue very early on. We work primarily with mice, which are the models we use to simulate human heart attacks. And what we found is that if you inhibit the scar tissue very early on, the animal actually dies, and you know, there's sort of catastrophic decline in heart function, and so we are trying to tease out now why this happens and what would happen if you sort of inhibit the scar tissue later on after having heart attack, not early on.
Fascinating, fascinating work. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Arjun Deb, about heart regeneration. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with UNC Assistant Professor, Researcher, and Physician, Dr. Arjun Deb, about his work on heart regeneration and stem cells. And Dr. Deb just awarded, actually, the CATS Basic Science Research Prize, one of the nation's top awards, really, for young investigators doing really novel and important scientific research.
Dr. Deb, you mentioned earlier about fish hearts, and it's just fascinating to me is it fish that you said could regenerate when they had damage to their heart? They could regrow their heart or that heart tissue, but yet we don't have that ability. I understand you're researching this. What have you learned, or what do we know about what they have and why they have it and we don't?
Yeah, and that's really the sort of billion-dollar question, is that why fish hearts, when you cut them, they just grow back, and it seems as if you'll never be able to even know that at one time you just, you know, cut a piece of their heart out.
Wow.
And in humans, it doesn't happen. And so we don't work with fish, but we do work with, as I said earlier, mice, which are the closest models we have to humans. And we found out very interestingly that the same mechanisms which sort of regulate how the heart regenerates itself in fish are actually conserved in these mice, which means evolutionary-wise, the same mechanisms still persist. And however, what we found out was that the same mechanisms which seem to be giving rise to new heart muscle in fish give rise to scar tissue in humans. And it seems like this is very important, because if you inhibit this process, the animals really develop catastrophic heart failure and die. And
so you were mentioning before that maybe the scar tissue helps us in some way, or at least allows some people to live after a heart attack.
Yeah, let me explain this in a little more detail. So the heart is a beautiful pumping machine, as we all know. It's mainly made up of muscle, which is the heart muscle. But it's also got other cells in it, and like, you know, blood vessels, which supply the heart muscle with the blood and oxygen it needs. But what's interesting is the outer covering of the heart, the outer lining of the heart, is something called epicardium, which just means, epi means above or beyond, so it's beyond the heart. It's a thin lining, just like we have on our skin. And the zebrafish also has this lining called the epicardium. And for years, we've known that the epicardium is activated in zebrafish hearts soon after it is injured. And what we found out is that the same thing happens in humans, or in mice, I would say, not in humans. The epicardium in fish facilitates formation of new heart muscle. And here in mice, we see that the epicardium facilitates formation of scar tissue. But the same mechanisms are being conserved. And what we hope is that if we understand how the scar tissue is formed by the epicardium, we can manipulate the signals so that instead of forming scar tissue, it can form new heart muscle.
Wow.
We're talking with Dr. Arjun Deb, UNC cardiovascular researcher. Dr. Deb, help us. Let's bring this back to these stem cells, and let's even fast forward. What would be the hypotheses that you have about the stem cells that you would hope to prove and that ultimately would translate into new potential therapies? Because I have this innate sense that you're on the cusp of something that could, if true, be revolutionary.
So stem cells can be broadly used to treat heart disease in two different ways. So, for example, you can think of it, say if you have a heart attack, and then what you do is you, you know, after you treat the person with medical therapy, then you give this patient stem cells. So you inject this patient with stem cells either to the bloodstream or into the heart itself. And you hope that these stem cells will actually form new heart muscle. So that's one
maybe
way.
Maybe targeted some sort of marker that targets them to the damaged tissue.
Exactly.
Selectively. Okay.
Exactly. So that's one way. The second way is the way we are interested in more is that you don't have to take the stem cells out. Let the heart heal itself. But understand molecularly the molecules and the signaling which is activating or inhibiting the stem cells, leading to formation of heart muscle or at the same time scar tissue. And we hope that if we understand these signaling mechanisms, we can then take the next step and discover drugs which then a patient can potentially take by pill form or given through one's veins that will target these stem cells, which already exist in everybody's heart,
like
to go down
them
the, exactly to go down the path of muscle formation.
So, I mean, if you are able to either generate the stem cells to give to patients safely in a way that helps them heal, or to give them a medication that makes their own stem cells work, I mean, that could change everything as it comes to caring for a really, really common, devastating disease process for heart attacks across America, across the world.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. I mean, if this works, it, you know, I mean, the sky's the limit. We could be seeing a new era of heart therapy and new ways by which patients can benefit from them.
Go ahead. No, it's actually
thinking of all the possibilities of how that would
Christy
change.
Christy and I, and I know our listeners have, you know, tens, hundreds, thousands of patients who in the region who have, you know, heart disease, and you're really trying to the modalities are all trying to take those remaining cells and help them be preserved, prevent further damage, but never really thought about. Are there, you know, other than the only thing that comes close to it for me is thinking about exercise and. Mm-hmm. and because exercise, I know if you work certain muscles, you can get them sometimes have a larger size and regeneration. Is there any interaction with the stem cells in something like exercise?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of information about exercise and stem cells in the heart, but we do know from this for sure that if you exercise regularly, you can increase the number of circulating stem cells in your blood, which have been shown to protect and augment your cardiovascular health. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at it, in every possible way, exercise and stem cells are related.
Well, that's very exciting. You know, I know we're going we'll be running out of time in a second, but I know for our listeners, and if they go to our website, we're going to put up some pictures of some of your work that I came across, some of the most colorful, beautiful
pictures
of things I don't understand. But cardiospheres from the adult heart and cardiospheres grown in culture, I find this exciting to look at. I hope it's exciting to be working on.
Yeah, this is something we haven't talked about a lot, but this is a new modality of growing stem cells from the heart. And these cells actually grow in spherical balls, and that's why scientists have called them cardiospheres. So it is exciting to see colorful pictures of these stem cells in our lab every day.
And well, probably to see the results is even more exciting.
Oh, yeah. It is exciting to think about how this really can change the lives of so many people. Thank you for the work that you're doing and for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with UNC Assistant Professor and Researcher Dr. Arjun Deb. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. On House Call segment of the show today, we will answer your questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
And we'd like to answer our very first listener question for House Calls. What do you have for us?
Hi, my name is Pamela. My dad just got diagnosed with diabetes, and I know it means that you have high blood sugar, but I don't really know anything more than that. Would you be able to give me the basics on diabetes and what it means to have high blood sugar?
Well, thank you, Pamela, for asking this question. I think so many people are either just assume that they know or don't want to ask exactly what are the basics of diabetes, maybe because it's so common. So thank you for asking the question.
Beyond the fact that high blood sugar is bad.
Most people know that.
It's high blood sugar and it's bad, but then it's like, okay, why is it bad and what do I need to do about it?
Yeah. So basic way I try to explain it to people is that all the cells in your body need sugar. And that we have some sugar in our blood that needs to get into the cells for them to be able to work. And insulin is the hormone that helps those cells kind of be activated for the sugar to come in. And if the insulin doesn't work well, or if you don't have enough insulin, there are lots of different ways that can be affected. But then you just get too much sugar in your blood, and that can damage many of your other organs, your heart, your kidneys, your eyes, etc.
You could be too sweet.
You could be too sweet.
Yeah. And what I say is, you know, when your blood sugar is out of control for a long period of time, it makes you go blind. It makes your kidneys fail. It causes heart attacks and it causes strokes. And if we can keep it under control for long periods of time, we can prevent most of that from really happening. So you get the cellular level, Christy, that I think you were right on about the description. And I want people to understand, though, it is a lifelong control that most people can do if they lose weight and do other things.
Yeah, if you keep going to the doctor, talking to your doctor, asking questions, and taking your medicines, then usually it's something that you can live with for a long time without causing a lot of those bad things happening to your body, as you're talking about, Adam.
So we hope that that helps you a little bit, with a little bit of information. We're sorry this has been diagnosed, but we really hope and believe that this can be controlled for you and really hundreds of thousands of other people around the country. What's our very next House Call question?
I've been hearing people talk a lot about using parasites to treat their allergies. Is this true?
Parasites and allergies.
Ooh, this is wild. I had to listen twice to make sure that I was hearing this right, Christy.
Yeah, so this has been in the news on ABC News and some different places about taking a parasite to help improve or prevent allergies. Some of this
came from this researcher, right? This researcher or this person who had some exposure and got better. What was that about?
Yeah, well, I don't know that whole story. You may know it better than I do, but I do know that there's some research sort of showing that if you've been exposed to parasites, that you may be less likely to develop allergies over time. So I think that's where sort of some of these ideas started to play out.
Yeah, this researcher went to some Asian country and exposed himself till he got parasites, and then claimed that his, you know, allergies were cured, and then started a for-profit group that promotes the theory that parasites are a cause of allergy, and if you expose yourself to these parasites, you can cure your allergies.
Yeah, I think whenever, I mean, when you hear a doctor or someone taking their own medication or taking their own something sounds yucky like parasites, you start thinking, oh, well, it must be true if he's willing to do it himself. But whenever there's a for-profit thing like that on research that's not really well-developed, I am suspicious.
Yeah, well, I went to the website of one of these, one of the founders, called Autoimmune Therapies, Christy, and I did happen to download the 8-page client agreement form, 8-page single-space client agreement form with 26 criteria that you have to sign off on and agree to. And
like
then finally,
when you get side effects from these worms, it's not our fault.
Oh, yeah, not your fault, not your fault. And how if you don't get better, not our fault. And then at the very end, the combination therapy to be paying for to get the hookworm or whipworm therapy for $3,000 to $4,000 out of pocket. I know people are desperate, but the science is not fully backing this treatment yet.
Yeah, and you could spend a lot less than that to just go somewhere and catch some parasites on your own.
Well, there is some interesting research looking at that these parasites can breed some immunity, but there's no research that says you can treat asthma in humans and atopic allergy and peanut allergy in humans using these therapies. It's crazy to take this right now, I think.
Yeah, be cautious and wary.
Okay, well, we were a little emphatic about that, but then this next one we're probably just as emphatic about. I think we have a house call about vaccines. Let's hear what we have.
Yes, I was wondering why I should get a flu vaccine this year. I'm 53 and I'm in good health and I don't have any chronic medical issues. So everybody's telling me that it's really important for me to get the vaccine, but I don't understand why.
Okay, this is a really good question. And because in particular, in previous years, the flu vaccine was only recommended to certain groups of people. And over the last year or two, it's been considered more of a universal recommendation.
Yeah, we would have liked to have already gotten the flu vaccination, but the reality is, we still have a good 6 weeks, probably of 6-7 weeks of flu in this area, and we're really kind of in the midst and the height of it. And so we would still recommend you're in a group over the age of 50, and really anyone under the age of 50 who wants to not get the flu, this is one of the most cost-effective interventions. It's safe and effective.
Yeah, I mean, particularly if you are an elderly person, if you're a young infant, if you're pregnant, if you have chronic medical problems, or if you're around anyone in any of those groups, then it's particularly important. And if you really think about it, that's almost everyone, which is partly why the recommendation is just for everyone to get it. So. Hopefully you've gotten yours and you won't get the flu shot.
And the reason is because if you get the flu, you will be sick for 5 to 7 days, sometimes 14 days. And some people do die. It is one of the major causes of death at this time of year and throughout the year when you average it out. So it's not just a benign illness.
And so far this year, Adam, we've had more childhood deaths in our region than any other in the country. So
Hope you understand why. Yeah. Thank you for a really good question. And what's our very last house call question that we have today.
I've been hearing about high fructose corn syrup not only causing people to get more calories every day and gain weight, but also having an influence on disease, such as maybe something to do with diabetes or affecting our hormones in our body that is just beginning to be looked at. Could you address that?
Okay. This is another really good question. Thank you. We've gotten some good ones today, Adam.
Yeah, and, you know, this is one that I think a lot of people think about. And if our listener hadn't articulated, which she did, then we would not be able to have a chance to answer. So we're looking forward to this.
Yeah. So when we are talking about high fructose corn syrup, we're talking about corn sugar, which is sugar that's put into sodas, fruit-flavored drink. It's really the most common added sweetener in processed foods and drinks in the world. So this is about, you know, some research linking added sugars, not just corn syrup, but other sugars into the food we have with some untoward health effects.
Yeah, and one of the major ones that people are concerned about is obviously a gaining of weight, that you're putting a lot of calories in here. And there is some evidence of that. There was a really interesting research article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition actually a decade ago that looked at if you drank soda that was sweetened with this high fructose corn syrup compared to soda sweetened with aspartame, that you actually gained weight with the corn syrup versus actually you didn't gain weight. You even lost a little bit the aspartame. So it's quite clear that the weight gain is real and it's not a good thing for most people.
Yeah. So, I mean, association with weight gain, dental problems or cavities, certain parts of your cholesterol go up, overall nutrition. So the recommendation is to try to cut back and be thoughtful about how much food and processed foods you eat that have these added sugars in them.
So and it doesn't really matter if it's really high fructose corn syrup or sucrose or just plain old fructose or glucose. These are, it's sugar and it's calories, and your body doesn't really know the difference.
Yeah.
But it's the additional calories they hear in addition to the problems Christy mentioned.
So trying to cut back on sugar sodas, thinking about what breakfast cereals you eat, and trying to just eat fewer processed and packaged foods overall and eat more vegetables and fruits are the general recommendations to keep yourself healthy.
Well, Christy, we've had a good chance to talk not only about this high fructose corn syrup and calories, but also about getting the flu vaccination 50 and above, as well as most people 50 and below.
About parasites, treating allergies, and that being...
We hope you don't spend the $4,000.
Please don't.
And the diabetes and the real reason, what it means, and hopefully getting it under control.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing your questions with us. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. And we want you to write us, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
You can visit us online, Your Health Radio, or going to Twitter and search for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Arjun Deb. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.